Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 12th, 2005. Presented in the Fireside Room by Paul Olson. Disc number OLP 2005-02. Let's listen in.
Just to break ice and we don't have very many people here, we can do this. Start up on top and just holler out who you are, where you're from. And if you've read this or not, that'll help me kind of know some things to say. But plan on me giving away the plot. My students say it all the time. Don't tell us that yet. Okay, way up there.
I'm Ruth from Edmonds, Washington, and I have not read the book.
Okay.
I'm Cheryl from Kent, Washington, and I have read the book.
And she's my dirt digging partner.
Doesn't he smell like diesel?
Still, 3 years later, we smell like diesel.
Ricky, Minneapolis, I've read the book, and I'm going to rudely leave for Dish Team, so...
I'll take it personally, that's okay.
Leanne, and I have not read the book.
Okay. Is it in the bookstore? I didn't even look. I looked at some other stuff. I don't think it is.
Renita, Saskatoon, I have read the book.
Carolyn, she's going to really leave for Dish Team.
I read the book a long time ago.
Oh, good, I can pull it over on you.
Yeah.
I can tell anything, okay.
June, and we read it in winter program here in the spring of 1985.
That's what I know.
So you could have trouble with a test.
Yes.
Okay.
I can remember the line.
Tom Lawrenson, I have not read the book.
Marge Lawrenson, we're from Fargo. I have read the book a long time ago. I've seen snippets of the movie on and off.
Yeah. Good, thank you.
What book?
The Color Blue.
I
haven't read it.
Purple, Peter.
Purple.
I didn't realize this, but I had this whole
Yeah, I was wondering
on.
About purple. Shouldn't you like display it at like a critical moment?
I did that the year the Twins won the World Series. I teach at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. And that's a little closer to Cardinal fan than it is the Twins fan. After the Twins won the World Series in 1987, I walked into class, I had my coat on like this, and I opened it up, and everybody booed. So I ain't displaying anything. I'm covered on my blue shirt, too, here. Okay.
Bob Bumpus from Renton, Washington, and I have not read the book.
Okay.
And I'm Emily from Renton also, and I have read it, but it's been a couple years.
Okay.
I'm June Scott from Seattle. I've read the book, and I've seen the movie.
Which was better?
Oh, the book. Always the book.
Yeah.
I think. I'm Judy. I'm from Seattle, and I have not read the book.
Okay.
I'm Kata from Iowa City, and I have read the book.
Have you read the book? Vano, is that who's up there, kid?
Hmm?
Who's up there?
Yeah.
We're just introducing ourselves.
Your name? Vano.
Yeah. Have you read The Color Purple?
Color Purple?
Yeah.
The
book?
No.
Okay, you're in good company. Lots of us haven't. Note that lots of us haven't. I'm really going to wait. Okay, well, thank you for that. And what I thought I would do was, the title of the session was Absolutes are Idolatry. Absolutes are idolatry. And the characters in this book have a lot of absolutes by which they live. And I think it's a complex, in fact, theological novel. That's what I call those kind of things. And so to get to that part of it, I'll just tell you some of the story and read some of the parts of the story that illustrate how characters are caught up in their absolutes. And what I mean by absolutes are, this is the way that you live. And I was going to start this, but I don't see very many people with paper, so I'll just illustrate myself. Start this with, if you had a piece of paper with you, and you just looked anywhere in Holden, but now I'll look out at you, and when I look this way, I see three people, kind of two and a half, and everybody else is gone. And the point is obvious, my perspective is surely diminished. And if I focus on this only, and I only talk to you people, and we're the only three people to talk about this book, we're going to miss a whole lot of ideas. And a drawing that I think works for that is that we look out at the world. I'm a great artist, as the poetry class is where you saw. We look out at the world through these glasses, or this lens, or this paradigm shapes our perceptions. And what we see is truth. But so is all of this around. And this absolute, I'm going to suggest to us, becomes the only way to live. And by doing this, when we're going to watch characters in the book, this truth alone equals death. And if not death, surely sickness. And you'll see one of the characters get sick just because it's brought about by emotional starvation. So out here, I'm going to say, as we get talking, we've got the color purple. And the line that we'll come to later, it's okay to give it away now, is that one of the main characters says, when she's describing God, I think it pisses God off when we go by the color purple and don't notice it. I'm going to run it by you again. I think it pisses God off if we pass by the color purple and don't notice it. And that's what these characters are going to be doing as we proceed through this novel, is that they're going to see straight ahead, and what they see is true, and what they see is historical, and what they see is traditional. But they miss lots of color purple. So at the end of this, not the end of the session, but the end of my little thing quick, and we'll get to your discussion, is I'm going to ask you, what are the color purples in our lives? And what prevents us from seeing the color purple? And rather than just kind of vague around in how's that for a verb? You vague around, Jen? We've learned that at Augustana. Okay. I thought of a quote. I was listening to Michael. I had to do announcements, and I ran back. By the way, my name's Paul Olson. I'm serving the village as an associate to the assistant associate teaching staff coordinator, and then I teach too. And back home, I'm an English teacher at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. And I coach track too, so I have a foot in two different worlds, but I think they're the same world. But. I was listening to Michael finish up, and some of you were there, and this relates to the color purple. Styron has a great line about Auschwitz in his magnificent novel, Sophie's Choice. Did not Auschwitz effectively block the flow of God's titanic love like some fatal embolism in the bloodstream of mankind? Relates to what we're doing. In that beautiful image, we have the bloodstream, and it's God's titanic love, but it gets stopped up by some giant embolism, and this one's called Auschwitz, in the bloodstream of mankind. And of course his novel suggests that this is a human responsibility, and we don't have to build those edifices like Auschwitz.
Aren't you going to draw a titanic?
I could. I thought you had to leave.
Not yet.
Okay, Ricky, could I draw the Titanic? Okay, never mind. She was in the poetry class this morning when I drew too. But this is a mast. Okay, let's get off.
A mast.
That was a mast in the story.
Label it.
Yeah. Okay, that's enough silly stuff. Right off the bat, I guess I'll ask you two simple questions. In your mind, what, and I'm going to write your answer on the board, what is a family? What makes up a family? It's an easy question. I mean, you all come from a family of some sort. What makes up that family?
I think love.
Okay, that's... love is the abstraction. What are the vehicles that carry that love, that make that love? Who are the people? I'll put it this way. Normal family. I don't mean this. You don't have to get politically correct. I'm just talking about our history, American history. What? Yes.
Mother, father.
Yeah,
children.
Mother. And so there's one woman. Equals the mother and the father, I heard you say that, and that equals one man. And what else?
Children. Two and a half children.
Okay, two and a half kids. I've always hated to be that half kid, that's what I thought I was growing up. That's normal. And then there might be some, you know, if we're lucky to have an extended family around us for a while, it might be a grandma or two and grandpa or two. But that's the normal family. And then my next question to follow, and this, we'll pay attention to that, is What's a normal novel like? I mean, the novels you've read, those of you who have read The Color Purple know it's not normal. But what is a normal novel? It starts out how?
At the beginning.
In the beginning, so yeah. So there's a chronology. Normally, that is consistent, progressive. there's a lot of them that aren't, but that's pretty common, especially with, yeah. What else is normal about, you know, the characteristic of a normal novel?
Character,
what?
Character development.
Say again?
Character development.
Yeah, we're going to develop a character, and we're going to do that for, you know, sometimes first person, second, third, or an omniscient narrator. We'll talk about this, and that's pretty common too. Well, right off the bat, in The Color Purple, we're going to be told, you know what, you're going to have to broaden your focus right from go. Because it starts out not like once, I'm being, you know, oversimple, of course, once upon a time or in the beginning or the full page of, you know, the physical setting, the environmental setting of the story. It starts out, dear God, and it's a letter. And those of you who have read it, you know that, but those of you who haven't. Dear God, and I'm going to read that first letter. It's very short. I am 14 years old. I am, and she draws a line through it. So in the book, just to set us up for that, well, I'll take too much time doing that. In the book, she just draws a line through that, I am, and changes it to, I have always been. Right from go, what is your reaction to that? I am, well, I better finish it so you know what she's talking about. I am a good girl. And she crossed out I am and changed it to have always been. Here again, I am 14 years old. I have always been a good girl.
Something's changed.
Though. Something's changed. Maybe I'm not so good anymore. And so in the opening line, we're going to have somebody set us up for, I've always been a good girl. That's the truth. But something has kind of invaded this now, and my line is blurred, and I don't know how to judge that. And well, we'll continue. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me. And then with some pretty graphic language, she describes the rape from her father. It's not her father, as it turns out at the end. It's the man that her mother married, but it's not her father, so it's rape, but it's not incest. And that matters as she learns about herself later on. But the two points I wanted to make was, one, she's got, something's happened to this focus in her life that's made her change her sense of herself. And then also that I don't have anywhere to turn but to God. And dear God, the first two letters in the book, it seems to me, opens us up as readers to say, you know, I think there's going to be some God stuff here. Or it's going to be what I've called a theological novel. Dear God, I'm 14 years old. I've always been a good girl. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me. And what's happening to this 14-year-old girl is she's pregnant and she doesn't understand it. She doesn't understand menstrual cycles. She doesn't understand anything and how you get pregnant. Well, that's our beginning. And then this young girl gets kind of, it's more complicated than this, gets sort of sold off to somebody, to a guy who's lost his wife. And she has to marry this guy. She doesn't want to, and she's 14 years old, and this guy has three kids, and her job then essentially is to take care of those kids. And I think I will erase this so we can keep our characters straight. This I am girl is Celie, and she marries a guy that we know as later as Albert. She always calls him in the novel Mr. and leaves a blank. She doesn't want to call him by his first name because she doesn't like him very much. But Celie marries Albert, and Albert, through his other wife, has three kids, one of whom is a guy named Harpo. You'll see why I'm doing this. Harpo, I'm really skipping through because I want to get to this Color Purple thing. Harpo falls in love with a woman named Sophia. Oprah Winfrey, did she get nominated for Academy Award in that role? It's absolutely brilliant. Oprah Winfrey, in the movie, plays Sophia. And the movie isn't anywhere, it isn't even close to the book, but it's pretty good, and Oprah Winfrey is magnificent. Harpo, I have to get to my notes so I can get through this faster than I would otherwise get through it. Harpo and Sophia start having a relationship that's not approved of by her father, so all they can do is sit in the parlor, or they don't have a parlor, the front porch, and then at 9 o'clock, father sends him home. Well, somehow they get away from father, guess what? Sophia is pregnant. And Sophia, then they say, well, now we have to get married. And that's where I'm going to just read a little example of how Sophia thinks. Well, I don't have to even go there. Sophia, Harpo brings Sophia home to meet his father. Harpo's father is Albert. Celie just observes all this, and Celie is the narrator through the whole novel. Harpo brings Sophia to meet Albert, and the first thing Albert says, I see you're in trouble. And her wonderful comment is, not trouble, big though. There, now, we've got this perspective, this line, I'll come back to it, this focus on, in American, you probably, especially people that are my age or around there, when a girl got pregnant, when we were kids, what did our parents say about the boy and the girl together? That's a bad question, but I'm going to leave it out there anyway. Something has to happen now.
They have to get married.
They have to get married. In the wonderful book by Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, she is pregnant. This is autobiographical. And her mother says, do you love him? She says, I haven't seen him in 6 months. Does he love you? I don't know. He hasn't talked to me. No sense ruining three lives. Uh-huh. We'll take care of this. So it's a whole different perspective. Not have to get married, but let's look at this, what Peter said earlier, what makes a family go. Let's look at love, not convention. We got to have a father, we got to have a mother, and so on. Okay, so already we know Sophia's got a little different outlook on things. That, well, yeah, I'm big, but I'm not in trouble. This isn't a bad thing, and I'm going to take care of this kid, and I'm ready to be a responsible mother. And she is. I'll introduce another word here. Conventional is what Albert expects, and unconventional is Sophia's attitude toward this. But Harpo and Sophia do get married. Harpo assumes Sophia will take on the traditional role of a wife. She'll stay at home, she'll raise the kids, and he will be able to go off to work. He'll be able to, you know, keep her in tow, and the way he keeps her in tow is by beating her. But he thinks. As it turns out, he can't beat her because she's bigger and tougher than he is. But that's what Albert does to Celie. And in fact, at one point, Harpo comes to Celie and says, you do everything my daddy say. Why doesn't Sophia do what you say? Or what I say? And Celie says, she loves you. I don't love Albert. Well, that doesn't matter to Harpo. He says, but I want her to mind. And Celie says to her, to Harpo, the way to get her to mind is, and here's the quote, I say, beat her. So even Celie is caught up in this traditional role. I don't know how else to make a relationship work. I don't know how else to make a woman mind other than to beat her. So even Celie, who's been victimized by this, would say, you know, you think, well, love her, gentle, hold her, do her work, share the workload, you know, something else. But Celie, too, says, beat her. Because Celie, and she's going to grow out of this, has got this vision, this tunnel. She's questioned it, as I read in the very first page. But she's still pretty much trapped in this one-way look of this is what a conventional marriage is. The husband beats the wife. Okay.
But there's more to it than that, because that's all Celie ever experienced.
That's all what?
Celie. She only experienced that at home, too.
Yep.
It wasn't doing things for love. She was beat at home, too.
Absolutely. That,
so
right.
To her, that's the norm, the beating.
Yep. And I'll add your word to that. This is the norm. And that's what Celie knew. That's what she tells her to do. That's very good. Okay, so we've got this trying to make it a conventional relationship, but it doesn't work. Sophia, like maybe Oprah Winfrey, isn't going to be in for, she's not one of those kind of wives. And now I'll just read a couple excerpts. And Harpo isn't that kind of man either. He doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to beat his wife, but here it comes. He's with Sophia now, and this was a lazy, good-for-nothing kid, Harpo was, until he got married to Sophia. And he was like this before. He'd come to the field, pull 2 ears of corn, let the birds and weevil eat 200. We don't make nothing much this year. Then he meets Sophia. But now, Sophia coming. He always busy. He chop, he hammer, he plow, he sing and whistle. Sophia look half her size, but she's still a big, strong girl. Arms got muscle, legs too. She swing that baby about like it nothing. She got a little pot on her now and give you the feeling she all there, solid. Like if she sit down on something, it'd be mashed. She tell Harpo, hold the baby. While she come back in the house with me to get some thread. She making some sheets. He take the baby, give it a kiss, chuck it under the chin, grin. Look up at the porch at his daddy. Now, this isn't how his daddy lived, but this is how Harpo wants to live. And his daddy, Albert, says, well, here it is. Albert, blow smoke, look down at him and say, yeah, I see now she's going to switch the traces on you. He's going to take on this female role, and she's got this male role, and that's bad news. What kind of a man are you? Yeah, I see now she's going to, so we sure don't have, you know, parental approval of that. Well, it gets more complicated. Harpo wanted to know what to do to make Sophia mind. He sit out on the porch with his daddy, and he say, I tell her one thing, she do another. Never do what I say, always back talk. Now, Celie's observing this, and Celie then says, to tell the truth, he sound a little proud of this to me. So Harpo's got a woman that's strong and independent, and he's proud of that, but he can't. Because that's not the traditional role. Now, again, it sounds like we're just into this whole, the simple look at a society's role for women and men. It gets much more complicated. This sets us up for that complexity, I think. So to tell the truth, he sounded a little proud of this. Mister, or Albert, don't say nothing. He blows smoke. I tell her she can't be all the time going to visit her sister. We're married now, I tell her. Your place is here with the children. She say, I'll take the children with me. I say, your place is with me. She say, you want to come? She keep primping in front of the glass, getting the children ready at the same time. You ever hit her? Mister asked. Listen to this wonderful line. Harpo looked down at his hands. Nasa, he say low, embarrassed. What kind of a man am I? You ever hit her? No. Well, how do you expect to make her mind? Wives is like children. You have to let him know who got the upper hand. Nothing can do that better than a good sound beating. He puffed on his pipe. Sophia think too much of herself anyway, he say. She need to be taken down a peg. And then Celie says, who's observed all of this and has observed the growth of Sophia and Harpo. I like Sophia, but she don't act like me at all. If she talking when Harpo and Mister come in the room, she keeps right on talking. If they asked her where something at, she say, don't know, go get it. I think about this when Harpo asked me what he ought to do to make her mind. I don't mention how happy he is now, how 3 years pass and he still whistle and sing. And I think about how every time I jump and Mister calls me, beat her, I say. The conventional way is the only way. And already you can see it coming, can't you? Where's the color purple? And we're missing it. And Harpo's going to miss, he's going to surrender seeing this color purple. I think it pisses God off when we pass by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. And Harpo's got, we know, right? Look at the purple that's there for him to see, but he can't see it. And because he can't, this is how he responds. He eating, Celie's observing this again, he eating more and more every day. Maybe he got a tapeworm. She frowned. Nah, she say, I don't think it's a tapeworm. Tapeworm make you hungry. Harpo eat even when he ain't hungry. What? Force it down? This is hard to believe, but sometimes you hear new things every day. Not me, you understand, but some folks do say that. Last night for supper, he ate a whole pan of biscuits by himself. Nah, I say. He sure did, and had 2 big glasses of buttermilk along with it. This was after supper was over, too. I was giving the children their baths, Sophia talking. The baths, getting him ready for bed. He's supposed to be washing the dishes. Instead of washing plates, he's cleaning them with his mouth. Well, maybe he was extra hungry. Y'all's been working hard. Not that hard. And this morning for breakfast, darn if he didn't have 6 eggs. After all that food, he looked too sick to walk. When us got to the field, I thought he was gonna faint. I have a note in my book here. My wife is a hospital chaplain, and one of her contentions of dealing with, for 19 years, with people who are dying or people who love people who are dying is that grief will come and bite you somehow, some way, unless you work with it. So you might get physically sick, you might be depressed, you might break, I mean, all kinds of ways, and it'll come later and later in life. It can come 20 years later if you haven't dealt with that grief or if you haven't dealt with what's there in your face. Well, Harpo hasn't dealt what's there with him. That is, I want to be this guy who can chuck his baby, give it a kiss, hold it, be motherly to this, quotes around that word, to this baby. But Dad says, I see she's switching traces. And because he can't be what he wants to be, he begins to, he's sick, and I'm going to use the phrase, he begins to die. How do you live if you can't see the color purple? Well, this morning he had 6 eggs. After all that food, he looked too sick to walk. When us got to the field, I thought he was going to faint. If Sophia said, darn, something wrong, she had said, darn if he didn't have 6 eggs. Maybe he don't want to wash dishes, I say. His daddy never washed a dish in his life. You reckon? He seems so much to love it. To tell the truth, he loved that part of housekeeping a heap more than me. I'd rather be out in the fields or fooling with the animals, even chopping wood. But he loved cooking and cleaning and doing little things around the house. He sure is a good cook, I say. Big surprise to me that he knew anything about it. He never cooked so much as an egg when he lived at home. I bet he wanted to, Sophia said. And then Sophia, too, responds. So here's Harpo not being the complete man that he wants to be. And then what happens to that relationship? Sophia, I'm getting tired of Harpo, she say. All I think about since us married is how to make me mine. He don't want a wife. He want a dog. He your husband, I say. Got to stay with him, else what you going to do? My sister's husband caught in the draft, she say. They don't have no children. Odessa loved children. He left her on a little farm. Maybe I go stay with them a while, me and my children. Sophia go on frowning at her glass. I don't like to go to bed with him no more, she say. Used to be when he touched me, I'd go all up my head. Now when he touched me, I just don't want to be bothered. Once he get on top of me, I think about how that's where he always want to be. She sip her lemonade. I used to love that part of him, she say. I used to chase him home from the field, get all hot just watching him put the children to bed, but no more. Now I feels tired all the time. No interest. The death of the relationship because neither one can be who they want to be. More characters enter. Harpo, Sophia does leave Harpo. And Harpo takes up with another woman. Her nickname is Squeak. And I got to put that up there. We won't talk about her, but what happens here matters. Squeak. And then in the meantime, Sophia picks up a boyfriend, has another child by this guy, so now she has 6 kids. And then Sophia, in a wonderful scene, is asked by a white woman, I didn't even mention this, that all the characters in here are black. And this is, of course, a novel you would read maybe in an African-American literature course. Sophia is approached by a white woman who said, your children are so clean. Do you want to come and take care of mine? And she says, hell no. And it's the mayor's wife. And the mayor's wife says, what did you say? I said, hell no. And the husband, then the mayor, comes walking up to, you can't talk to my wife like that. And Sophia winds up and pops him in the nose. And of course, then goes to jail. And their family is broken up. And her jail term is considerable. In the meantime, these 6 kids... 5 of them are Sophia's and Harpo's, and the 6th one is Sophia's, and his name is Buster. All 6 of these kids are taken care of by Harpo and Squeak, and they are loved, and they are happy, and in fact, Harpo at one point says, little Henrietta, she's my favorite daughter, and Sophia says, not yours, though. What say? his favorite daughter becomes one that's not his, and it didn't change a thing once he found out. It didn't change. So you already see that this normal family of a father and a mother, when we really have, you know, a girlfriend of Harpo, and a kid that's not either one of theirs is part of it, and is the joy of the family's eye. And then Sophia gets out of jail in a complicated, wonderful way, and I might tell you that Squeak, who Sophia punched her out, knocked two of her teeth out, because when she was dancing with Harpo, Squeak tried to cut in. But all three of them come, or these three people begin to live together, and it's Squeak, who risks her life, is beaten up and raped in order to get Sophia out of jail. Is that unconventional or what? I'm going to go get my husband's, or it's her boyfriend, but her live-in partner. I'm going to get my partner's wife out of jail so she can come home, and I'll risk my life to do it. And she does. In the meantime, so we have this, Peter's, that's a great word to start out, this love is working in this family. But Harpo and Sophia can't get back together because Harpo still has these ideas about what a husband and a wife should be. A girlfriend is okay. Then I'll just skip over this. Remember the first letter was from Cecilia, said, "Dear God." And that is where she turned when life was so confusing and she was so mixed up. You know, it isn't dear mom, dear dad. She can't go there. This is a God problem, and it's big. But by the end of the book, she can't turn to God. God has been, and that's why I started out with Steiner's quote that fit. This outlook on life and the presentation of God that she has gotten is the embolism that stops up the titanic love like some giant embolism in the bloodstream of mankind. So she then writes different letters, and I'll come to those. But before that, and this is the heart, here's where we get to talk about the color purple. Another main character in the book is an old girlfriend of Albert's. Her name is Shug. She's a beautiful, sexy singer and dancer. And she comes back to town, and Albert takes up with her again. And the city doesn't care, because she doesn't love Albert. They sleep together just in the next room. CD's over here, you know, taking care of the kids like she's supposed to. But Shug changes Celie. Shug and Celie have a homosexual relationship. And it's short-lived, but it's the only time in Celie's life she's ever been loved for real. She's not exploited, she's not just made to cook and do the dishes. She is loved by Shug. And it's much more complicated than I'm making it. But Shug has some ideas that try to broaden this, remember that original telescope I gave you, broaden Celie's views. And she gives those views when she talks about God. And she scolds Celie, you told me about the letter. Why don't you write to God no more? God's just a big old white man with a gray beard, and he's never done nothing but take away my sister and my daddy and my mama and killed my two kids. And Shug has a response to that. And here's, "I don't write to God no more, I write to you." "What happened to God?" asked Shug. "Who that?" I say. She looked at me serious. "Big a devil as you is," I say, that is Shug, you're a dancer and a singer and you go to nightclubs. "Big a devil as you is," I say, "you're not worried about no God, surely." "Just a minute. Hold on just a minute here. Just because I don't harass it like some peoples we know, don't mean I ain't got religion." "What'd God ever do for me?" I asked. "Celie," she say like she's shocked. "He gave you life, good health, and a good woman that loved you to death." "Yeah, I know, and he gave me a lynch daddy, a crazy mama, a low-down dog of a step-pa, and a sister I probably won't ever see again. Anyhow, I say the God I've been praying and writing to is a man, and act just like all the other men's I know. Trifling, forgetful, and low down." In this look of Celie's at God, it's blocked by, you know, and we'll come to our own discussion about that. How has God been made by man? And now, at this point in the novel, man is a male. But it's going to broaden from man as man into man as all of society. We'll hear it. In this city, you better hush. God might hear you. Let him hear me, I say. If he ever did listen to poor colored women, the world would be a different place, I can tell you. She talked, trying to... That's what Celia's saying this about show. She talked and talked, trying to budge me away from my blasphemy, but I blaspheme much as I want to. All my life, said Shug, I never care what people thought about nothing I did. But deep in my heart, I care about God. What are you going to think? And come to find out, I'm sorry, this is Seeley. I cared about God, this man, I'm sorry. And come to find out, he don't think at all. I just sit up there glorifying and being deaf, I reckon. But it ain't easy trying to do without God. Even if you know he ain't there, trying to do without him is a strain. I is a sinner. Say, Shug, because I was born. Now, we don't need to get into any Calvinistic doctrine here. It's just, I don't deny it. But once you find out what's out there waiting for us, what else can you be? Sinners have more good times, I say. You know why? And we got to look at this, too. We look at sin. I want to jump back to Steyer and Sophie's Choice. One of the things that's clear in that novel. The American notion of sin is that we have been much more concerned about the little boy masturbating behind the bedroom door than we were about burning 900 Jews an hour in Auschwitz. And our morality was a little bit skewed. And so now she's looking at what sin is too, and we'll hear Shub talk more. Once us feel loved by God, let's do the best we can to please him. I'm sorry. Sinners have more good times. To back up, I can't remember where I stopped. Sinners have more good times, I say. You know why? She asked. Because you ain't all the time worrying about God? No, that ain't it. We worry about God a lot. But once we feel loved by God, we do the best we can to please him with what we're like. This is who I am. You tell me God love you and you ain't never done nothing for him? I mean, not go to church, sing in the choir, feed the preacher? But if God loved me, Celie, I don't have to do all that. Unless I want to. There's a lot of other things I can do that I expect God likes. Like what? Oh, I can lay back and just admire stuff, be happy, have a good time. I read a critic who said that Shug is just a hedonistic bitch. this isn't about hedonism. I can lay back and, you know, any more than it is that we lay back and look at the mountains. don't get me going on literary critics. Well, oh, she said, I can lay back and just admire stuff, be happy, have a good time. This sounds like blasphemy, sure enough, to me. She said, Celie, tell the truth. Have you ever found God in church? I never did. I just found a bunch of folks hoping for him to show. Any God I ever felt in church, I brought in with me. And I think all the other folks did, too. They come to church to share God, not find God. The Gospel of Thomas, Michael knows way more about this than I do, it has a different... somewhat different view of God as the kingdom of God is inside us, and Jesus emphasizes that more in that gospel, but in all of them too. Some folks didn't have him to share, I said. They the ones didn't speak to me while I was sitting there struggling with my big belly and Mr.'s children. Right, she said. Tell me what your God looked like, Celie. I'm too ashamed. Nobody ever asked me this before, so I'm sort of took by surprise. Besides, when I think about it, it don't seem quite right, but it's all I got. I decided to stick up for him. Just to see what Shug say. Okay, I say. He big and old and tall and gray-bearded and white. He wear white robes and go barefooted. Blue eyes? She asked. Sort of bluish-gray, cool, big though. White lashes, I say. She laughed. Why you laugh? I don't think it's so funny. What do you expect him to look like? Mister? That wouldn't be no improvement. Then she tell me this old white man is the same God she used to see when she prayed. If you wait to find God in church, Celie, she say, that's who's bound to show up. Because that's where he lives. Now, this is the male. You wait for him to show in church, this is what you're going to find. You're going to find this God that's defined and created by all the definitions of man. Now, you get the point. Now, we're way past just man, maleness. We're into... Shug, I say, God wrote the Bible. White folks had nothing to do with it. How come he looks just like them then, she say, only bigger and a heap more hair? How come the Bible is like everything else they make, all about them doing one thing and another and all the colored folks doing is ever getting cursed? I never thought about that. Here's the thing, say Shug, the thing I believe. God is inside you and inside everybody else. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it inside find it. And sometimes it just manifests itself, even if you're not looking, or don't know what you're looking for. Trouble do it for many folks, I think. Sorrow, Lord, feeling like shit. And you maybe notice the pronoun she's used for God. It's it. And Celie is taken back by that too. It? I asked. Yeah, it. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. Whether or not in our traditions we agree with that, he or she or whatever, we know that in almost every Christian tradition, well, not everyone, but lots of them, especially Lutherans, we're debating this whole notion. Well, Shug just, not down here in sin, Shug just eliminates the question. We'll call it an it, not because that she's defining it, but because she can't define it, just precisely. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. And later, they have a discussion about sex, and then we'll move out of this. Does God think it's dirty? Nah, God made it. Listen, God loves everything you love, and a mess of stuff you don't love. But more than anything else, God loves admiration. You saying God vain? I asked. No, not vain. Just wanting to share a good thing. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. Now, quickly, before I get to ours, in what you know already, what can we characterize in this novel as the color purple? This beautiful color, it's almost as pretty as my t-shirt, that Harpo doesn't see, that Albert doesn't see. What are they missing? Your silence makes me think that that's not a good question.
Well, maybe joy?
Huh?
Joy.
Okay, and so one of the color purple is joy, and what, now will be concrete, what a novel can do for us, what would bring Harpo joy? Well, that he just, they can't see it.
Cooking, taking care of
kids. Yeah, so I could cook and I could be happy, and I'll put down kids. The whole role that he talked about, chucking the baby and kissing the baby, and he likes being inside, he likes hooking, and he can't do it. And so that's the color purple. If I stay in here, this is purple. I'm not gonna because I'm switching the traces on me and I gotta beat her. Keep going. The color purple. That they miss.
The unconventional.
Everything. So along with joy, the unconventional, if you read this novel or read it again or just think back on it, the only relationships that work in the novel are the unconventional ones. Every marriage is a disaster. As if then, and Alice Walker isn't making a stance for homosexuality or against, this is the way it is, or against marriage. She's saying, let's, instead of looking at the convention of marriage itself, look at Peter's word way back again. Let's just see where love happens. And that's the color purple. And sometimes in this novel, the marriages get in the way of the color purple, get in the way of love because you got to beat your wife, you got to play the roles, yes.
But the whole problem goes back to the fact that people were treated as property.
Yeah. You know, that's a great point, and that's a whole other dimension of looking at a novel like this, realizing that the characters are black and that we've got the black experience, you know, stuck inside the American experience.
But it doesn't matter whether they're black or white. In
historical
society, women have been treated as chattel.
Yeah. So that's good. We've got this historical view of women and the historical view of black people that complicates it even more, too.
And children,
yeah.
Maybe being unconventional is just being true to themselves and doing what they love.
We didn't talk about it, so I won't bring that up. What else between Harpo and Sophia? What's the color purple? Here's the color purple in Sophia and Harpo. He whistles, and he sings, and he's happy. And he never worked in his life before, and now what's he doing? He's chopping wood, he's plowing in the field because he's got Sophia. That's the color purple. She won't mind me, Daddy. And so now at the end of these two bad diagrams I've got, we've got God and we've got sin. We've got the color purple, but it pisses God off if we walk by the color purple and don't see it. Just for the fun of it, jump into our own lives, whether it's your life personally, you don't want to do that, or American life, where we, well, erase all this, where the color purple is out there, but we can't see it because... I'll start with something really simple because I'm a coach. we don't at Augustana, but some people in some places, here we got, we've got athletes come out for the sport and we cut them because they're not good enough. I mean, they can't run, I coach track, they can't run fast enough or throw the shot put far enough or whatever they do, they can't do it well enough. So we cut them, again, we don't. And then, but that's a standard, right? We got to be able to throw this far or run this fast. And what's the color purple? If I cut this kid, think of some young, I coach men, so think of some young man that you really like, and I cut him. What have I missed?
Their personal best.
What else would I, just imagine, what am I missing? Think of the guy that you're thinking of, and tell me what you know about that guy, what I'm going to miss, because I cut him.
Oh, giving them the joy of...
I'm going to miss that smile that said, look at, I just finished. Good. And I missed it. Good.
The team... team you'd have with that individual.
Sure. Every individual coming to any group changes the dynamics of that group, and we miss that. Good. You got somebody in mind? Somebody you like? And I don't get to... Think of this person that you like, and that you'd like to have them meet me, because you're going to help me out here with your good friend, maybe straighten me out.
I've got a son that just lives in the color purple, and you would miss that because he wouldn't show up on time for practices.
Good, that's exactly right.
Off the team.
That's right. Practice starts at 4, and if you're not there, you're out of here. Yep. Well, keep going. What else is the color purple? We got teachers in here. A, B, C. Prevents us from seeing the color. Yeah.
Unconventional learners.
Learners, yeah. And we're finally learning about that, aren't we? The different kinds of intellect that different people have. And here's this kid who can draw great, and you get the point. Yeah. Now, go into theology, into God. The title of the session was, Absolutes Are a Form of Idolatry. And we end up worshiping those absolutes. I mean, just think of any kind of religious law that we know that sometimes we have to. One of the reasons I love the book of Ruth is that Ruth is a Moabite, and she comes back to Israel, and what's the guy's name that marries her?
Boaz.
He's got, I think, if I remember this right, he's got two laws to choose from. One is to take up his brother's, his relative's wife, and so that the name continues. But another one that goes against it, as Jeremiah and Nehemiah talk about, is you better not be marrying any of those Moabites, because that's bad, you know, we're not going to mix the Israelites with those people. And he chooses the law that's most loving. And never mind, okay, I know what the law says about marrying somebody that's not Jewish. It's not Jewish. But I also know this other one, and I'll marry her. Now, the book is more, it's about more than that, but that's one of the things that it's about. And he saw the color purple. Okay, keep going. About what my question was, religious law that prevents us from seeing God. If you can't think of yourself, think of the American way right now. What were the things in the election just about?
Yeah, homosexuals couldn't get married.
Okay. That whole issue, no matter where you are politically, and I'm not to get into that, we're just going to notice that Alice Walker's telling us, you know, we're missing something here. I mean, we've been told that this is marriage is this, period, no matter what, and you cannot make it anything else. What are we missing? I'm missing your son, to make an analogy. It's coming late to practice. I'm missing, if this were true, boy, Shogun and Celia could never have had this relationship that changed her life. Keep going.
Seems like the other side of it too, which seems equally important, is that very focused vision that sometimes what we're seeing specifically is only our romantic or romanticized notion of something, and that what's lacking from our perspective is some of the more difficult stuff that we're not wanting to see, and that so sometimes that, I mean, this is an odd way to think of it, but the color purple sometimes is in that stuff that's harder to see. That means that to see the humanity of somebody,
yeah,
that you have to see the,
yeah,
tougher stuff.
Yeah, I love that. And that little drawing, the stuff you're talking about, it's what stops up all that stuff. That, yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Flip side of that is that so often we think we have to find, see, experience the unique instead of seeing it in the ordinary. I mean, Shug's sense of the color purple is just, you know, probably some weeds out there in the,
yep,
field.
Yep.
Very ordinary, very common, and yet very profound.
That's a great example, and I'm interested to see, well, it's not about that tonight. One of John DeGraff's films, Take Back the Time. The time things that get in our way from, we got to work, we got to have a, I mean, one of his examples in his session was, we have to have a 3-car garage and the family room and the living room and 2,500 square feet. That's an affluenza. And then we got to work 60 hours a week, both partners in the marriage, to pay for this stuff. We missed the color purple because we've been we've met these demands in here. Great. Yeah.
They're always meeting on the front porch, and they're gathering there for conversation, and this could tie into the affluenza to like your garage right in the front of the house where you pull your car and,
yeah,
you can get there by car instead of wandering over,
yeah,
to have that conversation.
Yeah, great. We sacrifice, the color purple in that case is talking to your neighbor. We'll build a garage and separate it. We'll build a wall, a fence. How about in our churches?
Well, at the risk of,
huh,
throwing my aura in, not having heard the first part of the discussion, you talked about the absolutes.
It didn't matter, you go right in.
It seems to me that a lot of what has informed the moral discussion in the last election has been a kind of bibliolatry, a way of looking at scripture in an absolute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that your word, bibliolatry? I haven't heard it. It's an idolatry,
no,
of the Bible.
No, it's not my word.
Okay. Yeah. I had up here before on this vision, we had, this is what sin is. And we've got all of the moral codes that are out there that prevent us from seeing. I think the book of, who's the guy, Jonah, is a lot about that. Good. Great. More. Yes.
Maybe like a coffee hour culture where you profess something in church and profess to be welcoming in such a way, but like the hour of socializing afterwards, you are more exclusive. But there's this, but there are cultural rules that don't match up with the things that are being professed.
Like we go talk to our friends instead of the newcomer, you mean? Yeah, that's good.
We were told in this last election in places that if you were a Christian, you would vote a particular way.
Yeah.
Period. That may or may not be true, but that, you know, the bottom line was that.
Yeah. Well, we had some church saying you can't vote for somebody that's been supporting abortion. You can't, yeah. Well, let me end with how this book ends. Albert. Way back at the beginning here, Celie married Albert and didn't like it. But Albert comes around, and Albert is redeemed. And we find out near the end that it starts way back when Albert was a little kid. I mean, when I was a little kid, he wanted to sew, and nobody let him. They teased him. So he couldn't do it. And so he learned really as a young boy that there are certain things that boys do, and this is how you live your life. And no wonder he says to his son, so you're going to switch the traces on you. But he, through Celie's growth, he too grows. And this is how it ends. The old devil put his arms around me and just stood there on the porch with me real quiet. Now this is a man who's never embraced her ever, other than to really essentially rape her. And that's an embrace. It isn't. And stood there on the porch with me real quiet. Way after a while, I bent my stiff neck onto his shoulder. Mm-hmm. She's never reciprocated with any kind of gesture of affection. Here us is, I thought. Two old fools left over from love, keeping each other company under the stars. When I was growing up, he said, I used to try to sew along with Mama because that's what she was always doing, but everybody laughed at me. You know, I liked it. Well, nobody gonna laugh at you now, I said. Here, help me stitch these pockets. But I don't know how, he say. I'll show you, I said, and I did. And now I sit sewing and talking and smoking our pipes.
Huh.
Color Purple, thank you. We can talk, we got a couple minutes if anybody wants to. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
I think it's something as simple as Christmas that they have grown up such expectations of what you have to have and what you have to do to have the simplest joy in that new birth and that promise of God's love. And somehow, by piling all this stress and things on, we miss the very thing we're...
How many of us have had a disastrous Christmas in our life? Yeah, look at all of that. And why is it? What got in the way of the color purple? All the stuff you just said, you know, this joyous celebration of the promise. And I can remember my father-in-law telling my son, take off your hat. I wanted to say, but I didn't. This is my house. He can have his hat on. No. That's David. Go ahead. You might go. Ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say Santa Claus. The demon of Christmas.
He is the demon?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Is that your next session, Michael? Santa is evil.
I think I've done that one already up here. I know. So, I mean, you know, you're talking about law and absolutes. I mean, think about that. I mean, this is the song, right? You
better not
watch out.
Yep.
You better not cry.
Yep.
You better not pout. I'm telling you why.
Santa
Claus is coming to town. He's
no kidding, is that a fearful guy? My God, he sees you
when
I'm sleeping.
You're awake. He knows if you've been bad. I mean, talk about sinners in the hand of an angry Santa Claus. I mean
Jonathan
Edwards
said nothing.
Can't
yeah.
match that little, I mean, you know, we sing it so nicely. But I mean, this old Santa character, I mean, that's heavy law. And think about the way in which now you feed your kids with sugar and then tell them to behave or else Santa Claus won't bring you presents. I mean, it's truly torturous. But that's a minority report. we never had Santa Claus in our house. Just wiped all that trash out.
Well, the absolutes of...
When you were saying the pursuit of happiness, in what vein were you saying that about?
A joke. I mean, you get as complex as you want to. I say it to my students all the time. Does anybody have anything to say about life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness?
I mean, it's so dangerous. It's really supplanted belief. And it, you know, it is so upheld and ingrained because you just hear the pursuit of happiness and that you know, has to be like, you know, your life.
Yep.
And what it does is make individualization, you know, the idol to get ahead of everyone else.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, right. That's one of many things we have to be happy, isn't it? I got to be ahead of you.
And right along the time of the Reformation, when, you know, Martin Luther was saying you don't need those priests to have an individual relationship with God. Those two things together are very dangerous.
Yeah.
Very freeing for those of us raised Catholic.
Yeah. Well, there was lots of laws. Well, thank you. This is fun. You already did that.